Welcome to the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin, your source for real estate investment jewels of wisdom.
Welcome to the REI Diamond Show. I'm your host, Dan Breslin, and this is episode 199 on the iCandy Realty Fix and Flip Model with Steve Budzik. If you're into building wealth through real estate investing, you are in the right place. My goal is to identify high caliber real estate investors and other industry service providers, invite them on the show, and then draw out the jewels of wisdom, those tactics, mindsets, and methods used to create millions of dollars or more in the business of real estate. Steve Budzik is the managing broker and founder of iCandy Realty, a boutique real estate brokerage in Mokena, Illinois, serving the greater Chicago real estate market. Steve is also an accomplished high-volume fix-and-flip investor. Longtime listeners will remember Steve's past REI Diamonds episode where we discussed his high-dollar house flipping strategy. Since then, Steve has developed the Fix and List program to help his brokerage sell houses faster and at a higher price. The experience and contacts he developed flipping houses along the way has dovetailed neatly into this new program. Steve has built both his brokerage and real estate investing business with a priority on high-level service to the marketplace over high-volume advertising. Our conversation begins with Steve's evolution into the fix and flip business model, his views on how to mitigate risk both as an investor and as a real estate agent, as well as a few reasons he believes every real estate agent should offer a program like this. Let's begin.
All right, cool. Welcome back, Steve. How are you doing today?
Good, good. Thanks for having me on the show, Dan.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess it's been maybe 2017 or something like that, maybe even 2016. Like one of the early guests of the REI Diamond Show is returning.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I love it.
Nice. So rather than start with the origination, since we have that on the previous episode and we'll make a link to that, maybe you can kind of give in the last, let's say, 24 to 36 months or whatever timeline you think would be more appropriate than that, the evolution of your business model and the reasons why you've evolved that business model, which I'm going to assume had to do with market conditions as they've significantly changed, certainly in the last 18 months, but we're kind of already progressing in that direction. Before COVID even hit. So I'll turn that over to you.
Yeah, cool. So I would say if I just backtrack the last 3 years, I really was coming from more of a position of just being on the agent side. And over the last 3 years, you know, we did rehabbing heavily on our own, like we were buying our actual own deals, did a little wholesaling here and there, bought and sold some rentals. So really kind of tapped into a lot of different, I guess, ways of investing other than just being a traditional real estate broker. But really the number one option that we've really been pushing right now, and that's just because of value and, like you said, market conditions, is our Fix and List program. And the program very simply is where we will actually flip the seller's home. So we'll come in, we'll analyze what repairs need or should be done. We'll then pay, hire, manage the whole process, and then we'll list and sell the property, get reimbursed any of the construction costs when the property closes. It's a real win-win for the seller. It makes for a much quicker sale. We're selling the property for more money, which means they're putting more money in their pocket. And it's a win even for the buyer, because as we've seen this market shift, there is many less buyers that want to fix up the home or put any sweat equity. You know, you have the investor side or the as-is buyer who wants it at a discount, or the retail buyer that really wants it move-in ready.
Nice. So before we get into that, I want to take a little bit of a diversion, just like philosophically, if we could, Steve. We get a lot of fix and flip investors. We get wholesalers listening to the show. I started out wholesaling, flipping back in 2006. You were kind of coupled with the iCandy, and you guys were doing these million-dollar flips, I think, when we first met, when I got to Chicago a few years back. And I think you had your license at that time. I've gotten my license since then. but I'm kind of noticing this trend. Maybe it has to do with the licensing board looking for investors to be a little more regulated and getting the licenses. I think it's a good thing to have the license, and I don't run out and list property all the time, but at least it shows at every level of people who are investing. I mean, you got to kind of understand what agency means. You got to understand what a mortgage is. You got to understand kind of what title issues are. And I think it's key to have like a little more of the background in real estate. Even if you are an investor, it's like, look, you go to some seminar and then you're kind of unleashed, but maybe you should also understand kind of how the professional aspect of being licensed and real estate agents also works. And so I think it's a good thing for people to level up their professionalism and get a license. I'm curious if you would kind of share that same thought process, or maybe you have something different to add.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, I can see why they did it. And I do agree that it is a good idea, as it kind of regulates the space a little bit more. It raises the bar at entry, you know, so you're going to have less people that are kind of fly by nighters or just really taking sellers for advantage of them, where like I've heard plenty of stories where, you know, investors would lock up properties only to the day of closing, they would disappear. So I really would say that it has definitely raised the bar for barrier to entry and really given much more of an understanding of the actual transaction to investors, wholesalers, you know, anybody that's in the market that wants to do real estate to any more than one deal per year.
Yeah, true enough. True enough. Cool. So with that, let's talk on the fix and flip program. So you talked a little bit about doing some renovations, kind of preparing it for market. I've done a number of kind of more joint venture, not really a fix and list. So we might put in significantly more work. It might be swapping a kitchen, might be whatever, changing a bathroom, putting a roof on, changing the air conditioning unit, getting the property ready to be sold on the retail market. So it's probably similar to the fix and list, but we kind of felt like we're taking a risk on our construction costs, $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 worth of construction. I don't want to be in a position where I'm chasing somebody around. And I've been kind of taken for a ride by sellers where we did the work. Then we get to the point of putting the property on the market and all of a sudden they change their tune and don't want to do it. Like I'm just considered, we're out the money in those instances where that happened. It's a risk that we took. We were trying to, you know, get them out of a situation that they were in that house. They wanted to be out from under the mortgage. We prepared it for sale and we're just beat for the money. So I prefer now, if I'm going to take a certain amount of risk with my construction, my time and my effort, I kind of want a little more of the upside than just the listing personally. That's kind of how I feel about the risk versus reward on a joint venture deal. And you're now doing something different where you're okay with that risk of the seller kind of going AWOL and disappearing on you and causing problems. Or maybe you have like a balance. There's a certain amount of repairs and fix and list the fix portion. There's a certain amount of fix we're willing to do for the agent side. And I don't know. I mean, would you consider more fix for like a JV? I mean, what does that look like when you're kind of measuring the risk going in as an agent versus maybe it's a joint venture investor kind of a deal?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. And we've also done that where we've actually done a joint venture with the actual seller. The biggest thing that has really helped us is having a specific contract in place that literally outlines every single term, right? So they're agreeing to it in regards to the list price. What do we do if the property, you know, doesn't sell in the first 2 weeks? Will there be a price drop? Having all of that in a contract form that's then recorded on title has really helped us a lot. But in regards to your question, we like to keep the threshold under $20,000, right? And our commission is on a sliding scale. The more money we put in, the higher the commission. Once we tip the scale over $20,000, it then does start to become more of a joint venture where we're actually starting to take some of that profit that we're creating by doing the repairs. And for $20,000, you know, maybe if there's a retail seller or somebody that's not in real estate listening, all of our pricing is much more geared towards wholesale pricing. So we can do a lot. In fact, we just closed on a deal just a couple of days ago in Oak Lawn, where we put $20,000 into the home. We were literally able to touch everything, painted the whole house, refinished the floors, outlet switches, cover plates, vinyl flooring, you know, landscaping, tuck pointing. So we're able to get a lot done for that $20,000. And our timeline is very short. That was a 3-week project for us. Put it on the market, sold in 7 days. So our out-of-pocket doesn't really get to be that long of a cycle, because our projects are super fast. We have all of our team in place and we're able to execute. So we mitigate our risk by a couple of things. One, keeping the threshold of work lower. I always tell the seller, I want to do the least amount as possible, but get you the most amount in return. And again, keeping that threshold at 20,000, once it tips the scale over and above that, we'll just have to structure and be creative on the deal and with the terms in different ways.
Nice. So what would the commission structure look like? You said you had this like sliding scale of a commission structure. Yeah. And you know, this question is probably less geared toward investors that are listening, right? And more toward real estate agents who are listening. It's like, how do I as a real estate agent approach a fix and list, let's say, with someone else? And to me, it's like, I'm going to do $20,000 rehab for 2.5% in commission on my seller side of the listing. I probably have better things to do at the time and don't want to risk the $20,000 in a court case enforcing the recorded contract. The arguments with this maybe seller, I'm fearful for the seller that goes AWOL and disappears. And maybe that just doesn't happen very often, or you're able to like measure the character of the people you're doing business with. But you're in a relationship with that seller, Steve. And that relationship, I believe, has to come with a commensurate reward for the risk you're taking. Is 2.5% it, or what does your sliding scale look like?
So the sliding scale is both based on how much money, time, and effort, as well as the price point, right? If we're going to sell a $400,000 house at 6% and get 3.5% and maybe put in $10,000 or $15,000, which we can get in and out in 2 weeks, makes sense for us. Keeps our guys busy. All of that process is pretty much ironed out. So it's not a lot of time per se for me. And then I'm able to continue on and go after new business. So yeah, if the house is $400,000 listing, and again, our threshold is dependent on the money and the price, you know, the higher the sale price, obviously the more commission. So it's a balancing act between the price and how much time, energy, and money we're putting into the property to really determine. But we want to make it a win-win, but we also don't discount our services. And our goal is always to get the seller 100% return, meaning if we're going to put $5,000 into the property, we have to be able to resell it for $10,000. $5,000 that it's going to be paid back to us for the repairs or updates, and $5,000 for them.
Why? 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 That target?
Because that's the incentive for us to really maximize the seller's value. And we know that the things that we're doing, paint, carpet, outlet switches, you know, the basic cosmetics will always get us a minimum of that return.
Makes sense. Is it kind of a risk mitigation thing? I mean, what happens if I put $20,000 in and then I was a little off on my value, or the market softened and the interest rates went up by a quarter point, or whatever happens, COVID occurs, the shutdown again? I mean, what about in those instances, and it sells for like, I don't know, significantly more than you thought on that initial opening offer? Are we making sure there's equity there? How do you protect that risk of prices changing once you've done the repairs?
Yeah, I mean, it's twofold, right? We know that we need to be working with a sane seller, and we need to know that the financial of the actual property is in a good position. Meaning, you know, if the property is worth 200, but the mortgage is for, you know, 160 or 170, that's too tight. You know, we want to see a percentage or a dollar amount in equity. Ideally, honestly, a lot of the clients that we work with, their homes are owned free and clear. So there's really not a risk there in terms of like, if it sells for a little bit less, you know, okay, not the end of the world. We can still close the sale. So we watch that and we have a list of questions that we'll ask the seller day one to make sure that financially the property is in a good place.
Are you guys pulling title before you start any of the work to make sure that they can actually convey the deed when it comes down?
Yeah, you know, it's on a case by case basis, but let me tell you, we've ran the red line on that one. We've never had a problem. We're doing on average one a week right now, and we've never had a problem, but it's really just being educated. And even like on Remind, which, you know, realtors have access to, you can see a lot of the history of the property. But every time we run into a situation, we're basically adding that to our checklist of questions. You know, were you ever married? Were you ever divorced? You know, how did you inherit this property? And we will get our, the attorneys involved day one. If it's like a probate situation, because as you know, that can be pretty sticky. Who's the executor? Let me see the trust docs. You know, when you know the right questions to ask, you can mitigate 90%+ of your risk.
That makes sense. I mean, my next question before I get to it, I'd frame with talking about our own business, and we have a lot of sticky titles in usually not highly valuable neighborhoods. And that doesn't matter to us. We're trying to do, we will do the heavy lifting. A lot of times the heaviest lifting for us is clearing title, tracking down five different people, getting signatures from everyone, getting them all on the same page. In a neighborhood where the place is going to sell for 35 grand and it's worth like 140, it's like a very difficult deal to get done. And we do those deals as part of us providing the service. And of course, when we get a deal in a $650,000 neighborhood, the title is often, most times, much more clean and easily passed than the lower price home. Probably a professional experience of maybe the seller, the history of the family, you know, college educated and really, you know, paid the bills and kept files, and then not so much in the lower price neighborhood. So that said, looking at title risk for me, I feel like there's certain areas where I have much higher title risk a lot of the time versus areas where it's not really as high. Do you select your geographic operating zone very intentionally? Are there areas where you're not going to go on a fix and list appointment, maybe because of the values, maybe because of the high crime in the area, the contractors maybe are geographically located? So if you could kind of describe the strategy behind site selection and market selection for you as an agent doing a fix and list.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really great question. And I agree 100% with you. Actually, the one that was a borderline deal that actually turned short sale on fix and list because there was a, you know, there was a mortgage that the husband who passed away took out that nobody else knew about, you know, that was in the South Shore area. So this more of the South side of Chicago. But to answer one question, so price, we really won't go below $100,000 on a fix and list because it just starts to not be worth it. And we're not going to take our guys and our team in a neighborhood that we just feel unsafe. So I'm not going to say specific neighborhoods, but you can get a good idea just by driving down the block. If there's more than one house that's boarded up, we're not going to go into there. And you know who I use a lot. I've got a fireman and a cop friend in the city of Chicago. I'm always texting them addresses, and the amount of information that those guys can give me. Honestly, the firemen are just sometimes as resourceful as the police, because the firemen are the ones going into those specific neighborhoods, and they've been in sometimes more houses than the police have. And it's honestly really interesting. Oh, that's a great block. Pride of ownership. You know, there's not a lot of renters in that area. You know, everybody's older. So it's pretty cool. Little side tip.
Nice. And like, I would probably frame that, right? So we're talking about kind of like listing and agent business, and we're addressing some risk, and you have this really unique niche offering with the fix and list program. And then a lot of us on the other side of the business being like more investor driven, buying, fixing, selling, redeveloping properties, I think it fits very good needs. So like in the city of Atlanta, when I went to the area around the Beltline, when the Beltline was just opening, it's kind of like the 606 trail that we have here in Chicago. Beltline is very similar. Old train tracks that are now biking path and everyone loves it. And there's pop-up beer gardens and restaurants, and it's a really cool vibe. And it's a great catalyst for redevelopment in that neighborhood. And when I got there in 2016 and first walked it, the Beltline wasn't done. It was like dirt, and there was like literally cranes dropping off like pallets of brick that were going to be used as pavers. And we like snuck on, we walked it, and I couldn't believe my eyes. And oh my God, there's so much opportunity here. And we fast forward 4 years later, that was the kind of neighborhood where there were board ups everywhere. There were potentially shootings occurring. There were, you know, a lot of risky situations that could unfold there. And a lot of the properties were cheap. They were 20, 30, 45, 50 grand. You'd probably have to like, you know, overpay to pay 55 for that property. Now there's very little board up inventory. Nice. Every house occupied, nearly all of them are renovated. And if you did find one, you're going to pay $150,000, $160,000, $180,000 in cash just 4 years later if you're going to get your hands on that. So I guess the point or the moral that I'm making is that even in areas that can be rougher without spelling them out, like here in Chicago and Philadelphia, Atlanta, and I imagine in other places around the country, we have this maturity that we're reaching due to lack of inventory and due to the need of housing. It's a really great thing, I think, for the U.S., for the city to now have values in these neighborhoods to justify people as investors who are going in, taking the risk, redeveloping, making a profit, and giving somebody a home to live in. And like that one board up on the block with seven board ups, suddenly there's like one board up left if you come back 2 years later. So a lot of that inventory that's really distressed is being bought up. And I think the other side justifies the higher profit because of the higher risk that somebody's going to take in there. And even for the retail buyers who buy on that block, when there are still seven more board ups, they're going to pay a lower price than when all seven of those board ups are finally renovated. I mean, barring any unforeseen market changes, that neighborhood will mature and those prices will continue to go up, and that person will have more equity once that whole cycle is done, and they're rewarded for kind of taking the risk on that unknown block to begin with. I mean, that's what Lincoln Park originally had, that same kind of dynamic. And we're talking like $10 million homes there now, you know?
Yep. Yeah, that's super cool. Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, so we have kind of the two aspects of the business. So we spoke, I can't remember if this is actually before COVID set in. You and I were on the phone, we're talking, and then you're like, I'm done flipping property. You like called me up specifically. Yeah. Done like rehab. I'm done flipping property. I'm doing this, this other thing. I'm focusing on this other stuff. Can you talk about taking off the investor hat in a sense and like really embracing and putting on the agent hat? I feel like that was a big shift and you did that. Maybe there's like a different combination of the two that you have now, but there was a point when you were like done. You like pulled the plug on the fix and flip stuff from what I remember and made the shift. Would you mind kind of touching on that, Steve?
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, when COVID initially hit, I think it was a interesting time for a lot of people. And as a real estate investor, which I would consider myself an agent and a real estate investor, you're always watching the market and making moves based on what you think is going to happen. I honestly would definitely admit I would have never thought that the market would have reacted the way it did or the way it has been. I think it is starting to cool off and level off. And as we will head towards a more normal market, we'll have to see the repercussions of all the decisions that were made over the last year. But as an agent or an investor, you know, the goal always is to mitigate as much risk as you can. You know, that's number one. And I would tell any agent out there that your goal also is to expand your income streams. So if you're doing just one thing, let's say you're just a traditional agent, I would advise you to look at other ways that you can provide services or products to your clients and make income. Because if one day one avenue dries up or slows down, you have other avenues to go to. And that's just something that I've really pushed ever since COVID is expanding the income streams, which is going to expand my sphere, expand the people I can reach, and ideally help more people.
Yeah, a lot of good stuff there. I just think back to when I had no money and I was like flipping houses and I was trying to figure out like which direction to go, and a lot of conflicting advice, in a sense that the advice is in books. The books are written and it's static. And so what I mean by that is the book doesn't really know where you are at personally, right? So you pick a book up, it doesn't know, oh, Dan Breslin is not an architect, and the guy who wrote the book was an architect making $180,000 a year or $150,000. I don't even know what they make, right? But they made a lot more than Dan Breslin was making back then. And they're talking about buying and refining property and putting 20% down. I'm like, oh, well, rentals must be the way to wealth. But I neglected to take inventory and didn't have the insight to think like, oh, shoot, I got to actually expand the income stream first. I got to figure out how to like build that income up, become bankable, get good credit, before I can actually like even look at kind of the rental thing. So I feel like that's my advice when people ask me, oh, how do you get started in real estate? Like, find a way to generate a ton of cash, like do a bunch of deals, whether that's doing deals as a real estate agent, probably a listing broker side, or whether that's figuring out how to find wholesale properties at good enough prices that you could JV with people who are going to flip, maybe. But maybe not. There's a lot of flips that I've done where we've lost money on the flip. And so there's like something to be said. Flipping houses can be a great way to generate a ton of cash, but you also want to acknowledge the risk that you're taking on in the purchase, in the cost of the supplies doubling during the course of ownership. Hopefully the prices will hold up long enough to recapture the profit on the flip side. And that's been the case for most of the people with our 6 to 8 months worth of inflation that we're in the middle of now. But flipping houses and being an investor does not necessarily come without risk. And I think that probably the biggest challenge for people with lower experience that I ever encounter, Steve, is actually understanding the risks that they're taking on. I think a lot of people are completely blind, just like I was, to the levels of risk that were taken along the way. And like, thank God I'd done, I don't know, 10, 20 deals before we had one that broke even. I probably did 100 deals or more, maybe even a 500 deals by the time I had done 2-3 deals that lost $100,000, $150,000 a piece. Like, you do business long enough and you're allocating more and more numbers where risk of 0.05% or whatever it is, you're going to encounter that kind of like unusual situation. And property doesn't sell for as much as you thought. There's a break-in, there's a flood, there's a whatever. The list can go on and on and on and on and on. So it's, you know, the answer is like, do way more deals than you need to. Make sure to expand that income stream. And then you can kind of cover some of that stuff to help mitigate the risk.
Yep. 100% agree. Focus only on income. People focus on all the non-income producing activities and, you know, they get static and stale.
Yeah. I mean,
one other thing, Dan, I just wanted to mention in regards to the fix-in list. You know, a lot of our clients right now are actually landlords who have owned rental properties, which now they want to sell because obviously they know they're selling for a premium. So that was just something that I wanted to tag on there. It's not all retail business. We're working with a lot of investors. In fact, the last few deals that we've done, we've even raised the money for them to purchase it, us to rehab it, and then we list it and we resell it. Now, those were quick, small deals in terms of renovation. But I believe it's just as anyone listening, it's all about providing value and service to as many people as you possibly can, and you will always bring in income.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because I wouldn't have had the insight to know your business enough for you to suggest that. So people who are listening in Chicago and have rentals are probably going to pick the phone up once they're done listening and, yo, Steve, come on, flip my fix and list my property for me. What other ways and methods? So you're on a podcast, maybe there's some landlords listening who are ready to participate. There's probably agents who are listening like, yeah, I know the contractors. I'm going to go get on such and such's podcast. I'm going to talk to my, my landlords too, and see if I can kind of be like the Steve Budzik in Atlanta.
Yeah.
But what other methods do you have intentionally of developing the flow of deals for your fix and list agency business?
I would say it's more so me marketing myself as just the go-to person. Like if you need cabinets, call me. You need countertops, call me. You need windows, you need roof, siding, call me. All of that. I have all the contacts. I can help anybody because I know that if I save them, for instance, you know, my sister-in-law saved her 60% on her windows. She's just never going to forget that. People will never will forget that. And they will always refer you business because they feel like they almost have to. But in terms of the other options, it's really going more wide. So when we meet with the seller, we can give them a cash offer. You know, we can do the fix and list. We can sell it as is. We can do a JV. We can do a, you know, a mortgage assumption. We can structure it. We can rent the property out for them. It's more so about giving them a ton of different options as each one of those is an income stream. And so I'm not really sticking to maybe one or two areas, but I'm always looking to see how can I go wider, wider? How can I provide more to my clients? You know, I don't work with a ton of buyers, but I worked with a buyer and we helped him do the rehab after he bought it, you know, so just more value. And this one person has referred me probably five other people in a matter of a year. You know, just from doing that one thing, I believe that the relationship with the client really begins when the transaction closes. Like that's when the real relationship begins because most people just drop it, cut it off, and don't talk to that person again. And I think that's when you need to come in. Hey, what do you need? How can I help you? So that was kind of a long-winded, but that was me just giving a lot of examples of how to go wide. And you could do this in any business. Real estate, it's generally easy because, or easier because there's just so many different pieces that people will need, or services or products that you could offer them. But I mean, I could go on a list mile long of services and products that agents could offer their clients, both beginning, during, and at the end of a transaction.
Yeah, it's funny. If you can hear the hammers in the other room here, literally the contractors that you referred me, Steve, are doing my condo renovation in the other rooms. Nice. What are a couple of those, let's just say, what are the top three to five things that agents should have a very strong referral contact that is a value add for their clients, you know, seller side, buyer side, whatever the case is?
I would say like, and I'm biased to this because it's easy for me. But contracting, like everybody needs a painter, a good handyman. I mean, hey, can you install my new appliances? You know, just do you have anybody for flooring? But I would say number one is a painter and a handyman, because let's be honest, homes break, right? And if you can be the go-to solving your past clients, every problem they have, you're going to be like God to them. You know, their water heater went out. No problem. You know, send my guy over and everything's my guy. You know, you're just solving their problem. So I would say a painter and a handyman. But I would, if I was the agent, what I would do is I would take your strong points of who you already know and use and market those. You know, if your uncle has an HVAC company, we'll market to everybody you know. Hey, if you guys need your unit serviced, if you need anything at all, call me. I can get you a much better deal with my uncle's HVAC company. That's just a simple example. Because HVAC should be serviced every year.
Yeah, yeah. We buy houses in the freaking... the filter is like sucked into the fan and it's like, you know, it was a $12, $20 filter. The HVAC company probably charged you $100 to $125 to come swap the filter. So it seems like a lot. Anyone who watches a YouTube video can figure out how to go to Home Depot or order the filter on Amazon for 10 or 12 bucks and slide it in there. But if nothing more than changing the filter, you avoid a $450 to $500 fan motor problem when the filter sucks in there and kind of seizes the fan up and it might even freeze the rest of the unit up. And it's like such a minor incremental thing. I love the value add of being the go-to person for a real estate agent because I get these like the market is this, here's a moving tip that, and it's this very like fluffy top level kind of all the Keller Williams agents are sending out the same newsletter because I get the same from four people at the same time, versus this little bit more custom tailored. I'm picking the phone up a month, 2 months, maybe even after I sold the property to such and such a buyer, check in on them, see how it went, and have a reason for the call because I'm touching base to see if they need any painters, contractors, whatever it is that I might have in queue. Maybe I'm reminding them the HVAC thing, whatever, but I've given a realistic reason to pick the phone up and call and follow up so that when that referral moment does happen, there is that actual personalized touch versus just the generic newsletter version. I think that the hesitation most agents would probably have is that you, like you said, take it for granted. You know contractors who give a good price. You've tried contractors, I would assume, and they failed and didn't pass muster, and you probably had a bad feeling and hopefully not a bad referral on your name and had a little bit of a customer service cleanup kind of a thing. But for an agent who is listening right now and was like, that's me, Steve, how the hell do I find a couple contractors and then risk my reputation and name by referring them out? Is there any quick solution for something like that over time for that person to build their Rolodex into something valuable?
Yeah, I mean, the easy way is to just ask for a referral. Like, go on Facebook and say, hey, can you guys refer me a painter? And then call what you feel are the top five painters and literally interview them and tell them what you are and who you are and what you want to do. Hey, my name's Steve Budzik. I wanted to give you a call because a lot of my clients have asked me if I know a painter and I don't. And so I want to ask you, can I refer you? Can you send me some of your past houses that you've painted? And can you send me some references? Literally interview them. Make it simple. And it's the relationship with that painter that that guy will be like, wow, that's really cool. You know, you're not calling him up asking for something. You're asking to give him business. And in exchange, you need to tell him, listen, if you know anybody that has any real estate questions or is looking to buy or sell, equally give me a call. But it's like a bank. You can't take a withdrawal when you haven't made a deposit. So I believe that you need to make a lot of deposits and then you need to start making or asking for some referrals as withdrawals. That way the relationship is very even in exchange.
Yeah. And I mean, in a sense, not that it's transactional. I know you're the kind of guy that just plants the seeds regardless of whether they grow. I think some people early in the career are going to come down and plant the seed and they're going to yell and holler and scream at the ground until nothing happens. And it's like, you weren't supposed to plant one. You were supposed to plant 1,000, 5,000, a whole field full of seeds that your harvest would actually be full. And that's like, you know, making the phone call to the painter and having the conversation, like demanding the referral right off and wondering why the guy didn't remember. Same guy who is the painter who has done your third or fourth client, he's like wondering how he can repay you at that point, maybe trying to like press money in your hand, maybe not. But like that at that point, when you're like mentioning the client thing, you've made the deposits and you're like justify the withdrawal, I guess, or, you know, being top of mind by kind of keeping money in his pocket. What would be a disqualifying answer to the interview? Someone, an agent has this painter on the phone, they ask for references. What would be an example or two that you've not called the person back, not felt qualified, didn't get the warm and fuzzies about their service?
The number one disqualifier is going to be this: the timeline in which it takes them to give you the information that you ask. If the guy sends it to you right away, I get it. If he's in the middle of painting a house, he's not going to send it on the spot. But if he doesn't send it by that, the end of the business day, that day, and you don't have to remind him, that's a disqualifier because that's how he's going to treat your client in regards to the customer service level. But as the agent, when you do refer your first person to this new painter, you should also equally show up to the job. It's your responsibility. And I know it sounds like a lot of work, but when you're brand new, you got to do whatever it takes to get more business. So you need to show up, you need to follow up and continue. It's just a rinse and repeat. You keep doing that and doing that, that person will probably send you one to two referrals that year. And if you can continue to do that, you can be a brand new agent closing two deals a month, no problem, for free.
Cost. Yeah, it's I'm sure there's like agents, maybe they have been lucky enough just starting to listen to a podcast like this one, Steve. Yeah. But they would be thrilled to like show up and talk real estate. I think about like the first like, you know, house or time I like looked, it's like, wow, this guy's gonna like take a meeting with me to potentially like fund my deal. Holy crap. This like the gods have smiled. They did actually smile, and that guy's still a business partner to this day. But it was I remember just preparing for the meeting and everything, and like looking forward to the meeting. And there's a great way for you to add value. Yeah, you're not gonna probably collect the check at that meeting, but you are showing face and building those relationships and putting in the work. So you said zero costs. So are you telling me you do no advertising at all? Do you do a little advertising? I mean, is what we talked about the extent of your lead generation strategy, Steve?
I tell myself and all my agents, you need to completely exhaust all of the free and low cost ways to market yourself before you think you're going to start to spend $1,000 or $1,200 on a Zillow campaign. And so I continue. Now I do spend money on print work and things like that, but my budget is pretty low. I send thank you cards, Starbucks thank you cards. Hey, thank you here, thank you there. But in terms of actual, like, I did try some Facebook ads, didn't have a ton of success. But I really don't spend a lot of money in terms of gaining new business. It's all referrals, everything. And so I do have a marketing budget. I take 10% out and I allocate that for marketing. So you could say that I spend roughly about 10% of my income on marketing. That would be pretty safe to say.
Got it. And that includes the Starbucks gift cards and the all that
stuff. That even does include some of the marketing on some of the properties as well. So kind of an overlay there.
Gotcha. That makes sense. It reminds me, so your philosophy toward advertising is different. Mine is to do huge advertising budgets, and that's kind of like a big part of our business model. And that's good. It works, and we've gained scale, and we have a good thing going, get our service into a lot of people's life, if you will.
Yep.
The beauty or the highly attractive value rating of, let's say, Microsoft as a stock comes from its ownership in part of LinkedIn. And LinkedIn is a valuable asset because it has a network effect in the business. And what that means is the more people that join the network, the more people that are on it, it's more valuable to the people on it and to the people. So it's this self-fulfilling cycle. And the network effect of a LinkedIn or Facebook also works the same way. Like, I can't just decide, you know what, Steve, I'm going over to this other social media thing and like everyone's going to go over there. The experience is horrible because the network doesn't exist there. The beauty of owning that network business, a Facebook or a LinkedIn in Microsoft's example, is that they don't have to like recharge this network. There's not like gigantic LinkedIn advertising campaigns. Like, you don't see LinkedIn ads on Facebook and you don't see Facebook ads on LinkedIn. They don't need to advertise to keep that network robust. We might see some propaganda Facebook advertising out there when things aren't going their way, but it's not in a sense to try to keep the network robust. And what that allows is the owner of that network to now monetize that network nearly indefinitely and nearly at a zero cost. So Facebook's ads pay out in large percentage all of that revenue to Facebook. Mm-hmm. LinkedIn pays out in large the revenue to LinkedIn, to Microsoft and that owner, which is a little bit different. Google's network is very similar, but Google also has like the AdSense campaign where people have affiliate, you know, traffic, and they're paying this one for their search presence and this one. And so there's actually a huge network and payments going out from Google to serve their ads on different sites, which is kind of the advertising model. So you have described putting together a more network effect type of real estate business that has lower risk in a sense that there's not a huge advertising budget, that if it came in and you just dropped $20,000 on advertising and something happened, you got an accident, you couldn't work for the next 2 months, it would have been a waste.
Mm-hmm.
So you do have this like way to mitigate the risk by building the network. And I think that personalized touch, the thank you cards, the handwritten notes, the Starbucks $20 gift card, whatever it is, like that personalized touch can be so powerful in building and maintaining that network at like such a higher level than you're ever going to get by putting together a Facebook ad campaign. And I think it's just like really, really, really solid that you described doing a business and that you're successful at that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I appreciate it. You know, I use the percentage. It's really like an 80-20. 80% of my business should come from my referrals, but you need to go wide. You know, I'm not a conventional agent that's just doing traditional listings or working with buyers, right? I'm offering to put windows in their house, paint their house, right? So I went super, super wide so I can get many, many more referrals, but it's 80% should come from referrals and 20% should be new business. Like I got a call today. I sent out a just sold postcard and the guy called me. He has two vacant lots that he wants to sell, one in Melrose Park, one in Schaumburg. So that would be new business. That would be that 20% I didn't know about him. And that was from a $150 postcard, you know, distribution that I did.
Nice. So what did we not talk about? What question didn't I ask that listeners are wondering or that you feel like we need to add one more bullet point here to our conversation?
That's a good question, man. That could really go down a long rabbit hole. I think the number one question that people ask is, how do I get started? How do I get started as an investor? How do I get started as a real estate agent? I'm in my 9-to-5 job. How do I make the transition? I think that's really the number one question. I'm sure a lot of people probably call you and ask you, you know, Dan, like, how do I get started in real estate? Or how do I get started in real estate? Like as an investor, I want to be a wholesaler. I want to be a flipper. I want to be an investor. How do I get started?
Yeah, I wrote the book on that. So when people sign up at reidiamonds.com, they get the book on exactly how I started with no money. And I think I did that to systematize the 30 to 40 minute conversation I would have. Not that I'm cold and I don't want to talk to people, but I found myself having the same conversation over and over and over. And I found also that, you know, people who are listening to the show right now, a lot of those people are like doing stuff, and a lot of people are doing stuff now. And when they started listening to the show 3-4 years ago, they were just getting started. So like following this podcast is like the answer to that question of getting started at a variety of levels. So we talked about agent and we talked a little bit about investor. This was more geared toward agents starting with zero marketing budget, like no money, trying to get in people's living rooms and just talk about real estate. So I think we laid a really good breadcrumb on the path here for that scenario. And we talked, you know, a lot of them are getting started in apartment syndications. We've had, you know, the list goes on and on. I did one that's going to be released. Well, it would be released, I think, a week or two ago when people are listening to this, on franchises. So someone could go into a franchise business, and a lot of real estate investors are plunking down 100, 150 grand, getting these different type of businesses and adding this other more reliable income stream to the channel, as opposed to relying on fix and flip, which you and I both know the fix and flip comes with that risk that it's good, it's good, it's good until it's not good anymore. And you're wiped out a year's worth of income in one deal and it's not good anymore. And that doesn't necessarily happen with the driveway or the handyman or the cleaning business, you know, like
exactly.
You have a bad month, you still made, you know, at the end of the day is something more reliable. So yeah, I do the podcast to help answer that question. And I direct people to go read that book. You know, it's a 165 page PDF. And I tell them, come back and, you know, let me know when it's done. I'm happy to answer any questions. And it's very, very rare that people ever circle back around after they've been given the homework, which is fine. A lot of them have gone on and found other avenues and ways. It wasn't specifically just to follow Dan Breslin's path or maybe work with our company. And they've become highly successful in a variety of things, from engineering, computer programming, flipping houses, you know, contracting business. And the list would go on and on and on for people to find the path that's really right for them versus just a real estate. And then we've had a handful of people who did the homework, listened to the podcast, tons and tons of episodes, and who are now business partners of mine, like running markets, and who are like highly successful. So it's like, that's kind of like my test, my first thing. I'm happy to give you the time, but you've got to invest some time in the relationship first. And let me know you can do the homework and pay attention long enough. And then I'm happy to take it from, Real Estate Investor 101 to Real Estate Investor 102, 103, 104, 105, 106, 107. And we'll go to like 120 or 30, I'm sure, all of us together here over the course of our career. But yeah, that's my very complex question to answer to a very complex question that the answer may not actually even fit for a lot of the people that ask the question, you know? So if it is, in fact, the question someone is asking right now, how to get started, the other question is evaluate the position that you're in. So for the architect making 90 or 100 grand a year, the answer is going to be very different than it was for Dan Breslin, who was broke. And people are coming from a lot of different backgrounds where some people are going to be like passively investing in yours or my deals. That's it. They're never going to take title to a deed. Some people are going to flip. Some are going to wholesale. Some are going to be an agent. And many, many others are going to go on to do a plenty of other things they were already on track to do in their life. And they were kind of curious and tire kicking at the time they asked the question.
Yeah. That's good. That's good.
Cool. Well, we're about at the top of the time together, Steve. My final couple questions here is, any recent book recommendations that you would make that might put some more color to the conversation that we had today, or just stuff that you found impactful recently?
I mean, my always go-to book is just the basic Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It's really what got me started. And I think it's important for a lot of people who are brand new. I think somebody who's experienced, they're going to, you know, there's so many books out there that, you know, they're all great in their own way. So that would be my go-to.
Nice. Yeah. My daughter is reading it. She worked with us for the summer. And I remember my dad gave it to me when I was like 17. I can't remember if I read it then. I read it when I was 26 and then got in real estate and kind of, you know, did the rest shortly thereafter. But my daughter had it for at least a year or two. I gave her the book. When I speak, when I do like a nonprofit speak to kids and see what the best way to describe it. Well, we did some work with the Love Institute and I would be invited to speak there and kind of share my story, my history, my background with kids who are a lot of them in the system, a lot of them living in a lot of these challenging areas. And they're trying to, you know, they're not really trying to avoid a gang life, but they're certainly not looking to get into that. And yeah. So get into these kind of programs that teach life skills, interviewing, applying for college, a lot of things that quite frankly, I had to figure out on my own growing up. And they help with that. And I always give that book out. So I have like dozens of Rich Dad, Poor Dad that I give out when we speak and we kind of tailor the talk around that.
That's cool.
Very colorful, interesting story that goes along for another day that podcast listeners won't catch now. But it was cool because the guy who runs our research division at Diamond Equity had my daughter working for him and he made it like a book study. Like, we're studying Rich Dad, Poor Dad. We're going to have our meeting on Friday. And she's like, well, I got to read it now. And so she's like now putting all these things together. What are assets? Oh, who gets the rent? Does the city get the rent? No, the city does not. They get the taxes off the top. They do not get the whole rent check. Like, that's not how it works.
Yep.
So it's been pretty cool to see her, you know, connecting the dots from Rich Dad, Poor Dad, which is probably what happened for you and I both when we read it. You know, the first time we got exposed to that different way of thinking about life and income. So cool. Good recommendation there. Any closing thoughts before we do our contact info here?
I mean, the one thing I always say, which is probably leading right into that, is if anybody has any questions ever, I'm always happy to help in any way I can. I get a lot of people that reach out to me, hey, here's the situation. What do you think I should do? And, you know, I'll help them out as quickly as I can. So I would say, don't hesitate, always reach out. And I would tell that to anybody listening, like reach out. Like if you have a question, reach out. I'm not saying call me or call you or maybe you can call me or Dan, but just reach out, period. You know, like don't get stuck. Don't let that be your barrier. So communicate. I mean, that's living.
Yeah, I would probably cap that with curiosity, right? My mentor, Dan Kennedy, told me a lot of things. And, you know, one of them that he was like very big on is that, you know, becoming wealthy, creating a business that's successful, something that's reliable, a lot of that has to do with the personality type that's like behind the creator of it and the curiosity. So it's the same thing you're talking about, Steve. It's like, how does this work? How can I do it better? how do I figure out this other thing? And he also said that the people who he knows, so he mentors tons of people with businesses doing $10, $20 million, $1 million a year, whatever, like lots of successful business owners through his career, Dan. And Dan Kennedy would say, you know, the person shows up and does business like they do everything else. And in his case, he's like, I want to know everything about my copywriting business and how this affects branding and all these other things. But he said, when I got into horses, I wanted to know about the wheels on the, you know, the little cart thing that he has. And, you know, this horse runs this way. And if I give it this nutrition that way. And so there's this whole thing. And I think about like me, like, let's say with weightlifting, it's like, okay, now if I tweak the carbs here and the protein there, and if I do the set this way, and there's like an endless variety of variables that are always being tweaked as a result of the curiosity of a successful person. And they're doing that with everything, whether they're renovating their own house in their kitchen, mm-hmm. whether they're evaluating a tenant to move into their property, whether they're engaged in a negotiation buying a property. Like, everything is done with this very curious methodology behind it, this like wanting to discover everything. And I think that is kind of exactly what you said, like reach out, be curious, ask the questions, like figure out, get to the bottom of. There's so much information out there, so many people out there, even at no charge on the internet, you can learn a whole lot. And then you get to a point where you find the right people who are, you maybe want to attach the chariot to a little tighter. So I guess in closing, Steve, do you want to share some contact information or a website where people can get more Steve Budzik?
Yeah. I mean, it's very simple. Google Steve Budzik. My cell phone is 630-935-0700. And you can check out iCandyRealty.com. That's our website. And thanks for having me, Dan.
Nice. Appreciate it. Thank you, Steve.
Low-cost capital is the fuel of any volume real estate investment business. As a real estate investor, I am sure you're well aware of these two facts. First, your business is driven by access to capital, or starved from a lack thereof. And two, you make more money when you reduce the cost of said capital. Whether you're looking for hard money loans to fix and flip houses, rental portfolio loans, or even a line of credit, Lending Home offers the most competitive rates in the market, currently as low as 6.49%, which is good for fix and flip single family loans. I pay 10% myself at fundrehabdeals.com to my private investors. So at 6.49%, if you like that interest rate, go to reilineofcredit.com. Even if you're not currently in the market for a loan at this very minute, I encourage you to still go through that 1 minute sign up process right now so you can get on the email list. That way, once you're ready and you have a deal or a few, their name is top of mind. Plus, as a bonus for signing up through reilineofcredit.com, you'll receive a free iPad when you close your first loan. That's reilineofcredit.com. Thank you for tuning in to the REI Diamond Show. Remember to review and subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. Just search REI Diamonds and click subscribe. Interested in receiving my weekly Big Idea email, where I provide the most valuable jewel of wisdom that I discovered during the recording of the most recent episode? Sign up at reidiamonds.com. At that site, you can also access the 199 episode archive. Again, that's reidiamonds.com. So last year, 2020, my house flipping business, Diamond Equity Investments, bought and sold 283 houses. And we've done 269 so far this year. Well, mostly houses, a few actually were apartment buildings, and we currently have another 149 more in our inventory, either under construction or awaiting close. Here are three more ways you and I can do business. Number one, if you are interested in having access to real estate deals you can buy, fix, and flip for profit, go to accessrealestatedeals.com. Number two, if you are an accredited investor who is seeking double-digit returns, You can sign up to receive my private mortgage investment opportunity emails at fundrehabdeals.com. That is how you join my network of private lenders to potentially fund my projects. And number three, last but not least, I am always buying houses that I can flip and occupied apartment buildings with below market rents. If you have a deal that fits that description in either Atlanta, Chicago, or the Philadelphia region, please send me an email with the details. Next up, we have John Seforek, the author of The Wealthy Gardener, joining us. The Wealthy Gardener is a book that teaches the mindsets that I've personally developed over a variety of sources over the past 15 years to build diamond equity investments into where we're at today. Many have called John's book, The Wealthy Gardener, The Rich Dad, Poor Dad for the Next Generation. I look forward to seeing John and you on the next episode, my friend.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the REI Diamonds Show with Dan Breslin. To receive email notifications of new weekly episodes, sign up at www.reidiamonds.com.